Hey, y'all, my name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 1st, 2008. My home group is the Germantown. Well, we don't call it the Germantown. We call it the Graveyard Group. We meet, and that's right, from the Promised Land, Memphis, Tennessee. Originally born there, but that's home for me and has been for quite a while. But my home group is the Graveyard Group. And, well, it's about as ironic as the Downtown Thursday Night Group, because they meet downtown on Thursday nights, and we meet in a graveyard at noon, 7 days a week. It's pretty crazy because we are absolutely, we have what, three pretty significantly large meetings all within, half a mile of one another, maybe, that are very well attended at noon every day right there, and people choose to come and sit in a graveyard, in the rain, in the cold, in the hot, with the ticks and the bugs and the trees and the wind and God. And that's a pretty amazing thing. I do have a little bit of of housekeeping I would like to do. We got to do something today. It was pretty special. I knew Marion not well. She was somebody that was working with my sponsor at the time in step work, and we had a few conversations, and I know there's some other people here that were, she was very special to, and they were, you know, and we went to the, what everybody here calls on the mountain, and we had a little ceremony for her, and we were certainly grateful to be asked to come up there. But while we were going through that, I was thinking about something, and it comes from 89, and it says, "Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish." And this was the part that really stuck to me. To see a fellowship grow about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. For new people, where am I, 4 month guy? Here he is, 35 days. That's what this thing is, right? And you know, the crazy thing, so when I'm thinking about that, I'm looking around the circle, and I'm seeing people that I attend meetings with in Alcoholics Anonymous since 2008. I'm with one of my best friends and my wife and the love of my life. I'm with people that used to be my neighbors, and I'm standing on the side of a mountaintop talking about God. And if you would have asked me that this time in 2008, I would have laughed in your face, because that's what I did to my mother. Because my mother said, "Your wife is leaving, and you need to go to an AA meeting." And I laughed at her. She was right. I was born in Orlando, Florida, and in 1973. And I always like to read this too before I start. "This painful past may be of infinite value to each family which has been relieved, owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others." Not for me, for others, right? That's the crazy thing. "With it, you can avert death and misery for them." You know, and I used to think that I worked Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 steps so that I would have a better life. And somewhere along the way, through good sponsorship and good friendship, and it was explained to me that I don't work Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous for me. At all. This is not about my life becoming better. It is a result. It is a byproduct of that, right? So, you know, living well, doing the things that you're supposed to do, you will have a good life. But for me, it's imperative to live this life so that I can help others. And that is my goal, generally, to do that every single chance I get. Excuse me. I didn't think I was going to be nervous, but My wife took all the nervousness, and then she went, "Phew," and gave it to me. I was born in Orlando, Florida, 1973. I was adopted. I do know my biological mother. She's a nice, wonderful lady. My parents are my parents. My mother and my father adopted me, and when I look back at my life, I think there's a couple things. So Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, I love to read it. It's a great book. There's a couple other books that I've read or started to read. One of them was called The Road Less Traveled. The first sentence in that book is, "Life is difficult." I put the book down immediately. I did not continue reading that book. I knew that already. And then another one was one that my wife had purchased for me for my birthday. And I read this paragraph, and I have since put it down because it blew me away, because my whole entire life was spent not necessarily feeling like I belonged where I was supposed to be, and I was always waiting on somebody to come and get me. And that's basically the gist of that paragraph. I'm delusional. And I'll tell you kind of how that looks for me. We were in bed the other night, and I told my wife, "You know, baby, I believe that I'm frequently wrong." And she started laughing, and she was just dying. And I thought, that's kind of inappropriate, because I didn't think it was that funny. And then I start laughing, and then she says, "You know," I'm thinking, "Ha ha, this is a funny thing that, you know, ha, ha, I think that I'm frequently wrong." And she says, no, "You are frequently wrong. The funny thing is that you don't believe that you're frequently wrong, you know?" And that is right? So that's the crux of my problem, right? Is that I don't believe that I'm wrong. Faced with the facts, I look at them and I go, "Nah, that's wrong. I'm right, that's wrong. I'm delusional faced with the facts." I have a sibling. Apparently I'm going to need this water. I think she's 44. I'm 40. I'll be 49 in June. She was adopted too. I don't recall having a bad life until I showed up. And I showed up at about 8 years old. And I was not a good kid. I was not a blue ribbon winner. I was disruptive. I was basically, by the fourth grade, I was in the portable building out by the basketball court back in 1979, 1980, 19, you keep going until they put me in places where there wasn't a basketball court or it wasn't, in a public area. My elementary school career was long. I had like three elementary schools before I ended up in one that where the doors locked behind me. I lived most of my adolescent life incarcerated, and it wasn't because of drugs and alcohol. I'd love to sit here and tell you. It doesn't mean that I hadn't done them. I was involved in that certainly, but I didn't spend a lot of time unincarcerated from the age of about 11 until I was about 17. Now we tried cinnamon and nutmeg, dried banana peels, tea. We tried to ferment oranges. Anything that the older kids where we were locked up said, "Hey man, this will do the trick." We'd set it in the window, or if it was in the right styrofoam cup, eventually it would turn to something that would alter you. But I had never really been altered at that point outside of, I guess in high school there was about 2 years. So I'll run through my incarceration. I went into treatment when I was 11. I got out. I did not participate in life appropriately. I was reintroduced to a more stringent treatment called juvenile hall. I incarcerate really well. I institutionalize well. I stayed there for a long time. And then I think I went to like a foster home, a boys' home, and and they would send me to regular school, and the regular school would say, "This kid can't be here." And I would end up back in juvenile hall. Eventually, sent me to a wilderness program, and I was there for 19 months or something like that. And I'm away from my family because I'm a danger to myself out there at that age. I was a danger to myself. I was a kid that like my mom and dad would wake up and I would be gone in the middle of the night on a bicycle, riding down 240 or what we have here, Highway 24 or 41, and nobody would know where I was. So I was good to be incarcerated. And, you know, it took Alcoholics Anonymous to really see that, right? Because I thought I had a resentment. And I certainly did when I get here at my parents. But what I realized through the work is that really they saved my life on more than one occasion. And, you know, it's been a very recent awareness of mine that my parents taught me how to be a man. And I never knew that. And this is pretty new, so I haven't really fleshed it out too well, but when I think about what my parents did for me, they showed me how to go to work. My dad passed away earlier this year, so it's a little bit fresh for me, but I've spent a lot of time in consideration there, and my dad showed me that, because he took me, when we moved to Memphis, he took me, and that's part of my story too, but man, I was a handful. You know, my dad got up every morning and went to work. He got up every morning, he went to work, he paid the bills, he did what he was supposed to do. And, you know, it was just up not until recently. I mean, really, when I say recently, I mean like a couple days ago, maybe 5 days, where I realized this is the reason that I get up, rain, sleet, or snow, whatever it is, no matter what my life looks like, even drunk, sober, whatever, I get up, I go to work. I've never had a problem with that. And no one ever sat me down and said, this is the list and how you live life. And it occurred to me that just by watching my dad do that, and I 5 days ago, I would have never given him the credit for that. I would have said, I just do it because that's what you do. But my dad showed me how to live through his actions. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the awareness to be able to see that. That's the gift, right, is the awareness, to be able to see things like that. But it's layered. I'm not going to see that at 4 months. I'm not going to see that at 35 days. It takes time. The good news for you guys is that once you're awake, you can't go back to sleep. Oop. 12 and 12 tells you that a belly full of booze and a head full of AA does not mix. Moved to Memphis in 1987. Moved in with my grandparents. I was coming from Orlando. I had a black mohawk, combat boots, flannel shirt, dyed jet black hair, and I moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and my poor grandmother and grandfather, what is this? You know, what is going on? And they were right, you know. I mean, I was sit up all night long and bang around. We had an organ similar to that right there. And I would sit in the living room and I would do this, and I had headphones on, and I was sure I didn't hear myself. You know, so it wasn't my problem. Again, a perfect example of what my problem is. Because see, if it's not my problem, then there's no problem. If it's your problem, that's your problem. Doesn't matter to me. That's how I live my life. And I didn't really, you know, just some other awarenesses that I don't have prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Eventually, my grandmother had had enough of that, and she said, he cannot live here anymore. And my dad takes me to the Motel 6, which is still there. I've taken my wife by there before. It's still there. It's over off Sycamore View and Macon Road in wonderful Memphis, Tennessee. It used to be behind Gridley's. Gridley's is not there anymore, but boy, Gridley's was some good barbecue. My dad loved it, man. And he put me in the Motel 6 at 15, 16, something like that. And I had a lot of buddies. Hey, man, I had a hotel room at 15 or 16 years old. And we could drink there and do everything else that you could possibly imagine that goes along with a 15, 16-year-old with a hotel room and all my friends. And you know, the funny thing, though, is that all my friends would leave. And again, another awareness that I don't have without Alcoholics Anonymous in reviewing those kinds of things is that my friends would all go home. And I didn't know that I was missing that, but I knew I was missing something. And man, we partied. You know, we had a great time. I'm not one of these people that's going to tell you that I didn't have a great time. I had a blast. I was 15. I was living in a hotel. I had all my buddies coming over and partying down. We had a a bathtub full of Meisterbrow. They would leave. The truck drivers and hookers would come down to check on me to make sure I was okay. And they were some of my best friends. You know, they would come down and they would make sure I had food. They would make sure that, you know, I wasn't too messed up. And, that's how I lived. And I went in different hotels, some of the best in the city, the Royal Oaks. That was the first Holiday Inn. So I'm just to be clear about that. When I was there, it was not the Holiday Inn. Admiral Benbow, both on Summer and Union. Some of these Memphis people, they know. Henrietta and Tim and them, they're shaking their heads. They know what I'm talking about. Yeah, the one on Summer is an Aldi now. Yeah. So in Bill's story, he talks about that. He says the ominous warning on the doggerel stone. He talks about that frequently. And what I see that as is where God intervenes in my life without my permission, right? Where God slips in. And this happened to me while I was there. I don't know what happened because I just lined out the perfect possible scenario, which is hanging out in the hotel, bathtub full of cold beer, all the other things you could possibly think to want. Nobody telling you what to do. You know, it was like Pinocchio. It was like Pleasure Island, man. You could just do whatever, watch TV all night. And at some point, I went to my dad and said, I got to go. There's something wrong. I need to go to treatment. Now, I asked to go to treatment, and he's like, you ain't got treatment. What's wrong with you? You know, my dad was the kind of guy, I came home with a broken arm. He told me to just take some Tylenol. You're going to be all right. My arm was bent, you know. I'd been skateboarding and ended up with a plate and a bunch of pins in my arm. But he told me to take Tylenol, you know. But I think he believed that there was a problem. And in that problem, I ended up in St. Francis. And, of course, you know, I went there in 28 days. And, you know, I was good. Or that's what my insurance company said, and I certainly was fine. I mean, you know, I was a miscreant. Wayne at our home group used the perfect word, man. He said it, and I never even thought about it. He said, I was a feral child. And immediately, I don't know if anyone here has ever seen the movie Nell with Liam Neeson and Jodie Foster, and man, I was like, whoa, that's absolutely 100%. I was feral, man. I was not speaking the same language as the rest of the human population. Another kid in one of our meetings said, man, I showed up to life, and it was like all the rest of you guys had a book and had taken the class, and I was not a part of that class for some reason, so I did not have the proper information. So I get out of St. Francis, and I go to another high school. I was four high schools in like a 9-month period in the city of Memphis before the city of Memphis high school system said, you're good, don't come back here. And I went to Bartlett High School, and you know, they pretty much said the same thing. I was disruptive, I was disrespectful, and I was all those things that a kid that was where I was at in my life would be. And ultimately I got arrested. They kicked in my dad's door, put a pistol to his head because I was selling drugs out of his house. We would come over, and I treated my dad's house just like the hotel room, you know. And we partied at his house, and we did, you know, it's where I lived too. But he had enough. And I tell you what, man, one of the things my dad taught me, and he never said, this is what I'm teaching you. That's the thing, man. It's like, he never said, this is what I'm teaching you. And I don't think he even knew this is what he was teaching me, because I don't even think he understood. I did get to tell him back in August when I spent some time with him. I told him I loved him, and I told him that the one thing you taught me is to never, ever, ever give up on people, no matter what. And he never gave up on me. He showed up at every visitation with McDonald's, with books, spent all the time, every visitation that I had, no matter where I was at, from the time we moved to Memphis until I was a grown-up and had run off to my next adventure, he showed up every time. And the Bartlett Police Department Organized Crime Unit kicked in his door in the middle of the night, put him to the ground, and put a pistol to the back of his head, and he still showed up. We got a program for that, right? That was somebody said earlier. But he taught me how to treat people, and I didn't know it. And I didn't know it until like 5 days ago. So eventually, I'm going to run through this one real quick. I go back to St. Francis, already been there. They're like, you're doing great. We'll send you, let you go home on the weekend. So I would go home on the weekend. And you know what we do on the weekend when we go home from treatment centers? Whatever we want to do, followed by like a lot of pickle jars of pickle juice, just in case, you know. And I got out of there, and I went back to juvenile court. And then I was waiting on a bed at MRC, and it was called Memphis House at the time. It was over on Vance. And I was waiting on a bed there, and because I had a problem, had a chance, something was not right. And I knew that, you know, I was in juvenile court, and when they talked to me, the judge talked to me, my dad was like, he's not coming home. Whatever we got to do. And the judge, you know, was like, well, let's get him some help. But we were waiting on the bed. So while we were waiting on the bed, I'm jumping around from treatment center back to the juvenile hall, out to what we call Tall Trees, which isn't there anymore, but it was like a mid-range lockup. We still went to Votech, but we did go back there and sleep at night, and we'd go home on the weekends once you leveled up. And of course, you know what we did there. I mean, I drank pickle juice, I drank vinegar, I drank, you know, mouthwash, whatever I could do just to like think I was like, and no one ever asked. When I'd come back in on Sunday with the other kids, nobody was standing there like I was, you know, they were like patrolling to see what we were doing. I don't know where I came up with the idea that I had to do this to. But anyway, so I end up back at juvenile court, and then I go back into, they take me to Memphis House, which is MRC now, and I go there, and I don't last long there at all, period, whatsoever. They want to help me, and I don't want help, or their kind of help. And that's probably right about that time is when I was really first introduced to AA, with the exception of when my mother, and I told Dirk this and Ralph earlier, is that I've been in Al-Anon since I was 12, technically, because my mom took me to an Alateen meeting when I was 12. Well, she went to an AA meeting, and she was like, go over there to the Alateen. I didn't know what it was, because I thought it was like the babysitter for AA. Right, like you brought your kids there, and you're like, "Hey, you kids, go sit there while we go to the AA meeting. Thank you. Be good." You know, it was like the prep room for AA is what it was, really. So I get out of my treatment center. I don't last long at Memphis House. Obviously, I don't last long anywhere unless the door locks behind me at night. And by the door, I mean the door to the cell. I don't mean the door to the house. I mean they put me and incarcerate me in a place where I don't come out. That's how I do very well there. My wife was talking about that I outweighed her, and what she doesn't realize is time doesn't mean a lot to me. I've spent a lot of time in rooms by myself, alone, days, weeks, because inside of facilities, I was the bad one, like getting locked up inside the lockup, you know. Man, something is wrong. Never heard anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly went to some meetings while I was in treatment. Old school meetings in Memphis, the old tower, the Triangle Group on Broad, Central Avenue, and people like Ralph, they shake their head. They're like, yeah, he went to those are the meetings. You know, I spilt more than you'll ever drink, kid. You know, and if you hear them talk in meetings today, they'll quote those people that sat in those meetings, things that they said, things that they were doing back then in 1988, 1989. And I certainly heard none of it. Zero, zilch, not one single thing that any of those spiritually minded people were saying. Not a single thing. I did smoke a lot of cigarettes and drink a lot of coffee because that's what we did. So I do get out eventually, and my dad takes me, and we're living back at home. And, you know, we go through. I mean, you know, look, man, when I take a drink of alcohol, I cannot control the amount I take. And when I honestly want to, I cannot stop. It means I'm probably alcoholic. Page 44. That's the end of when I say I'm alcoholic, that's what it means. But I'm stupid, you know. I am not opposed to siphoning out an air conditioner of Freon and like sitting down on the curb and just waiting it out, man. I'm in, you know, and anything in between. And this part, this ought to sum that up. So my dad sends me up to school because while I was locked up, I got my GED, and he sends me up, which is probably one of the best things that ever happened to me because I probably would have never done it. I certainly wasn't graduating high school. He sends me to college with some money to go register. Some of my buddies were in line registering for college, and I was like, what are you doing this weekend? And they're like, oh, man, we're going to the Grateful Dead show. Sounds like a great idea. I got in the back of a 280 ZX, and I rode to Richfield, Ohio in 1991 for the first Grateful Dead show I ever saw. And I came back a few times and then eventually went and just out completely California, West Coast. And, you know, my parents would get the call, you have a collect call from, hey, send that money to the Western Union. You remember the one you sent it to last time? Click. And they'd get that call. And that was their communication with me, you know. That was how they knew I was okay. And I, you know, lived this life where I was, you know, did not draw a sober breath. And again, it's one of those things where I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it wasn't, that I didn't have fun. I had a blast. My parents were worried about me, but I worry about my kids. You know, my kids are, I don't hear from mine that frequently. And I worry and wonder if they're okay. And hopefully I can come help them or whatever. And certainly would be available if they ever needed any help. But you know, they would only hear from me when I needed $50. And that's usually, you can imagine it, Thanksgiving, Christmas, birthday. I didn't know about all these other holidays that I could have probably gotten another $50 for, but they supported my party. About 1994, that party ended. I had a friend of mine die of heroin overdose, and I came back to Memphis and never messed with that stuff again. I did drink. We were talking about the bar and restaurant industry. My wife is absolutely correct. In the bar and we find our ways into the bar and restaurant industry. One of the things I benefited from was food. Because if you're a cook, you'll always have food to eat, which means guess what? You can spend all your money on other stuff. I always knew I was going to have something to eat. And you know, I went through that and eventually met my first wife and my oldest son's mother. And, you know, we're both candidates for Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. And it was not a good marriage. It was not a good anything. But we did have a wonderful son, and he's, you know, I love him to death. And, you know, I love him even more every day. The more awareness I have about my dad, the deeper my love grows for my son. Both of my sons. I have a second one too, but he's a little bit later. So needless to say, that marriage doesn't last. And I get involved with my second wife, and we have a child, but we had a child later in our marriage. And that was probably the one, like if I had to look back, you know, that would be the one where I was like, man, this was not good. You know, I did not act appropriately. I was drunk all the time. My job that I had supported that. I didn't know to not drink or to drink. It wasn't really a choice. It's just what I did. I did it all the time. And like everything that I'm talking about here, like there's never been a time where I really drew a sober breath from about 17 until 35. And I was in the 10th step. I wasn't fighting it or avoiding it. It was just how I lived. I lived it. That's what I did every day. That's what everybody did, right? Everybody drank like that. Everybody, you know. I thought I came home every night. I drank beer on my patio, a lot of beer, and smoked some weed and hang out. And I was an absent father until you came and expected me to do something. And then I became really, overly attentive father, meaning you interfered in what I wanted to do. And therefore, you were going to pay the price. I'm not entirely sure that I don't still act like that sometimes today, but it's certainly not where alcohol is concerned. And I tend to right the ship a little faster than I did then. I found Alcoholics Anonymous in 2008. Having basically run that, you know, participated in running that marriage into the ground, a business, and just about everything that, you know, I thought was important. I get arrested June 20th, 2008. June 27th, I get out. What's the first thing I do when I get out of jail? A buddy of mine picks me up, bails me out, picks me up. We make it out of Bartlett, because that's the bad place to drink, apparently. And that's one of the problems, Bartlett. And we make it down the street to outside of Bartlett. We pull over and we open a bottle and we start drinking. We go to his house and drink. And he's like, "Man, don't worry about it. You're gonna be all right." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm gonna be all right." Now my mom and everybody wasn't talking to me. No one was talking to me. Everybody was basically, my kids were gone. Everybody was saying, "Hey, don't come here." You know, I would have the sheriff's department find me. Somehow they had like a homing tracking device on me, I thought, because it seemed like no matter where I showed up, that a sheriff's deputy was always there with a piece of paper that said, "Don't go around these people." I literally just had this stuff taken care of, and I went downtown, and I was like talking to the guy, and he just kept pulling stuff up, and he's like, "Did you ever get the message that these people," I said, "yeah, they didn't want me around them?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, I got that message a bunch of times. Clearly, you have the paperwork." And the guy that I was working for and the guy to bail me out, we were in the housing industry, and he took me out to his model home. We had a model home in Oakland, which is a little east of Memphis. And he's like, "Look, man, you can stay here. And, you know, just make sure you make the bed before everybody comes in. And you're gonna, you know, we're gonna right this ship. You're gonna be all right. Don't worry about it." And you know, he left, walked out the door, and just like when all my buddies left the hotel room and walked out the door, and just like every time the guard left and walked out the door, it shut. It slammed behind me, and I think the gates of insanity and death. There's a loud clang. And when I read that, I knew exactly what that clang was. It was the door shutting behind me. And I didn't know that then, but when that door shut, I had something on my heart. And I mean, this is just the way God talks to me. I'm sure it's similar for a lot of people. A voice appeared in my head that was not mine. And the way I remember it and recall it at this point in my life is that it was my mother's. And with a statement that she had made probably 6 months prior to that, which was, "Your wife's leaving, you need to go to AA." And I listened to that voice, but I had a little detour to take. I went downtown. It was my birthday. June 29th was my belly button birthday. I was sitting on the river, and I used to wear a CPAP. And I had a CPAP mask, because I had all my stuff in my truck. So I had my CPAP mask and a hose hooked up to the tailpipe of my truck, and I was sitting on Mud Island with the CPAP mask on my face, and I would start my truck, and lo and behold, somebody would pull up next to me on either side, and I had to cut the truck off because, man, I don't want to screw this up. And for whatever reason, man, every time it would be someone pulling up next to me, and it just didn't happen, you know. And I went back, and I remember we were at, it was Stratford and Summer. Grimes United Methodist was my first meeting. I went in there snot-slinging, crying. I went to another meeting that night. It was of a different fellowship. It was in the basement of a church in Midtown, a Walker and Cooper, which is, for people that are from Memphis, that is a pretty rough area. People were smoking crack out in front of the meeting that were then coming into the meeting. It was a madhouse, and I loved every minute of it. I was like, "Wow, this is crazy." And there was like just as many people or more, you know, sober as there were coming in just wound completely up. And that was my home group for a while because I knew what that was like, man. I was like, "Man, this is where it is, you know. Craziness, but also interwoven with some spiritual stuff that people were talking about and the ability to get sober." And I remember being in that meeting and crying and snot slinging and just, I don't know why. I mean, it was just like something was leaving me, and I don't know what it was. So I couldn't go back to my house for about 3 months, and I entrenched myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I met my wife, and I had not met Ralph yet at this point, but he was, you know, about to get lucky and meet me, at, you know, a few years later, and, you know, his life has significantly improved since then. Anything that I say that you agree with, see me on this side. Anything I say that you disagree with, Ralph and Dirk will be standing on this side, and you can take it up with them. Too bad Marty's not here, but you know, should have packed better this time. Man, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved this book. I loved everything that it said. One of the first sentences that stuck out to me in Bill's story, it said, "My talent for leadership would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance." Knew it. They got it. Man, I had seen this book so many times and I'd never read it. And I've read it so many times since then, and every time I read it, it's as if I've never read it before. Something else comes to me. I believe We Agnostics is one of the most vitally important spiritual documents ever written. That's my personal belief and opinion, which makes it right. Because I believe it, right? And if you believe your opinion, then that makes you right too. So, and I'm always open for discussion. It's probably one of my most favorite pastimes is to talk through anything like that. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. First three months, man, I was in it. I was in it. Even though I was quite sure y'all didn't want me in it, I was in it. I was sure that when I went out to Waggle, which is in Bartlett, and I started having to go back to Bartlett. The people told me, "Hey, you can go home." And I went home, and when I walked in my house, I looked around and I noticed it looked exactly like it looked when I left it when the police drug me out of there. And that was an unlovely scene, you know? It's an unlovely scene. And my son was coming back from Florida, and I took a bunch of ibuprofen PMs, like a whole bottle of them or something. You know, it's like it's disrespectful to people that have suffered from that or had that in their life, but it was where I was at, and I was prepared. I just did not want to wake up, and I was 90 days sober at the time. I did not want to wake up. I didn't want my son to come home. I didn't want to have to face that. I didn't want to see those things. I want him to see me. I was ashamed of myself. I woke up a couple days later, I guess. I don't know, maybe a day, maybe, I don't know, who knows. Looking around, and I call my sponsor, and I tell him what's going on. You know, and he, my first sponsor was so understanding. I mean, he was... I got to see him last year. He came through town on his motorcycle because he was riding dirt bike trails to Oregon, weirdo. And and he came and, you know, he was like, "Man, I'm just going to stay for like 30 minutes, you know, 6 hours later. You know, and I never knew that I could love a human being. I never knew that. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous gives me, is the ability to love human beings. And I didn't know I had that capacity. I call him, I tell him what happened. He's like, "Hey, man, maybe you ought to try working the steps." I was like, "Maybe I ought to try that." And that was my first entry into step work. And I did my first fourth and fifth step with him at the corner of Walnut Grove and Tillman in an old coffee shop upstairs. Man, it was the greatest thing ever. It was my dump truck. I call it the dump truck because it's just like I just backed it up and dumped it. Prepare for a long talk. You know, he fell asleep. I was offended. And now I'm telling myself that I have fallen asleep in subsequent fifth steps of other people's too. And when I wake up, I tell him, "Don't worry, you'll do the same thing. We're just not as interesting as we think we are, you know." Because everything I'm saying is everything I see. Like, I get to AA, everything I just told you is what I'm ashamed of, right? And I get to AA, and you're like, "You need to talk about that with another human being, or you won't be free." And I'm like, "Oh, well, I don't want to do that." Well, I just did it. And I would pull everything I just told you, if it could help me navigate a troublesome situation, I would do everything that page 100 says. I would pull the worst parts of my life out. And I just glanced over it. So you guys can piece together the things that were going on, you know, when I'm locked up and incarcerated at 11 years old for periods of time that I was. I would pull those things out and I would tell them if it would get me out of a jam. But you get me into Alcoholics Anonymous and say, "This is going to save your life." I'm like, "Oh, man, let's not overreact here. Let's pump your brakes, man. That's a lot." But I did it. I did the work. I did that work. My first fifth step was thorough. It was utterly as thorough as I've ever been. I told everything. The whole, you know, the chicken, the pig, all of it. I told all the stories. And I'm free because of that. And I haven't had to tell that again. Like, that's not who, that's not my jam. Like, if you go and you do a fifth step with somebody, you don't need to revisit those things. At least that's where I'm concerned. Now, the problem with the fifth step is it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller the more of them you do. You know why? Because you get closer and closer to the problem. See, because when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got like 17 pages of problem. And really, there's only one page of problem. That's Bill. Bill's the problem. Like, that's the only common denominator throughout all of those 17 pages of problem. The only one is Bill. I don't understand that 13 years ago. It takes a lot of work. A lot of work. A lot of outside work, too. I mean, at 5 years sober, I went to a therapist for a lot of years. He saved my life. You know, and I used to suggest that to guys I would take through the steps. I'd like, you're good, you're done. Here's his number, go call him. I'm not a professional. I'm just a bozo on the bus, man. You know, you got some things you need to talk about that I couldn't help or cover. I'm here to assist you in any way, shape, or form, but it's good to have some professional assistance in this area. I suggested that every single time. I've been very lucky. I was without job for a long time when I first got sober. I got into a job with a friend of mine. What, do we have the time? I don't have my, am I good? You can just give me this. Okay, I wanted to make sure. Ralph asked for a long talk. So I want to make sure, no? 10 minutes. All right, condense. 10 minutes. She says 10 minutes, so you don't win. She's got the red pants. You put the red pants on, we'll cut it out right now. There you go. Anyway, so... I get a job, and I was so lucky, because for years I worked with guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody that worked for us were in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are the best of pals, man. I mean, we spent all the time together, and you know, outside of AA or outside of work at meeting and stuff like that, we were thick as thieves. And you know, we've all moved on along the way, but it was a great time. And you know, I've worked in downstream petrochemical for 12 years, and last year was the first time that I was unemployed. And I'll tell on myself. Chris told on herself last night. I don't have quite as long as of a absence from Alcoholics Anonymous as she did from Al-Anon, but I was probably gone, I'd say 2 years, something like that. And I would tell myself, look at you, look around. Great house, beautiful wife, great dogs. You know, you're not locked up. You're current on all your bills. You know, 2019 came and went, and my bankruptcy had gone away. I was becoming square with the universe. And I got lazy. And I didn't go. I didn't attend AA. But I would tell myself, you know, look, I don't attend AA, and if somebody calls me, I'll tell them, hey, you know, AA worked for me, but I don't attend AA, so here, you need to call this person, you know. So I was being honest. And I lost my job, and this was last year, April 29th of last year, I separated. It was a mutual separation, because you can't pay somebody that's not working. You know, that's not a good business model. And the company that I was working for, they did that for about 4 months. And I can't ever, I mean, they paid me a lot of money to not really do much. And I would go to Baton Rouge, and I was helping clean out a warehouse, a lot of chemical, we did chemical cleaning work, and there was a lot of chemicals and stuff that I was helping clean out. And I'm there, and I'd been going down there for a month, is it a month? Something like that, a month. And I'd been going in and out of this cabinet. And I would get, so we had these cleaners, these rail car cleaners, and they were abrasive cleaners. They were robots, and they had eyes, and we to clean them, you'd have to use a dust cleaner, like compressed dust in a can. You clean that, like keyboard cleaner. We'd use that to clean the eyes off so they would work. man, I've been going in and out of this cabinet, in and out of this cabinet, post-it notes, things like that, because again, I was cleaning up chemicals. I had to make sure I identified what was correct and what could go together and what couldn't and what had to be separated appropriately so that things don't go boom. Nobody likes that. Man, I opened this cabinet door one time and I looked down at the cabinet. I looked down and I see the corner of a book and it's blue. And I knew exactly what that book was. I knew it. Like, it was like, again, that's the way God shows up to me. Subtly, but very loud. And I had been talking to some friends that had been calling me, and like one of my buddies, Doug, and he would call me when I would be traveling, and he wouldn't let me get off the phone. He would say things like, "Well, do you have a plan? So it seems like you had a plan that you were following that was working pretty well, and then you're not following that plan anymore. And if you have a new plan, I'd be interested to hear the new plan." I didn't have a new plan. Mine was just damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Man, I'm going to drink this whole bottle of water. If it was smart water, I'd be really smart by now. Let me come back to AA. Man, God showed up for some. I mean, it was the wildest thing. I came back and, man, just things would just show up in my head and on my heart that I couldn't explain. Just couldn't explain it. It was as if, you know, I saw that corner of that book, and I knew it. It was like, man, it was the craziest thing, you know. It's so challenging to describe God, right? Because it's indescribable, right? The book tells us that we cannot comprehend or define that which is God. And I'm attempting to do that, and I'm terrible at that because I know that there's no words to describe what I had experienced. And I come back, you know, and I don't want to say I come back to AA because, you know, my wife works for AA or works at the intergroup office, you know. I mean, it's not like we had disappeared and I came back. I mean, I was just obstinate. But I felt like, well, as long as I'm honest with people, that's what I'm supposed to do. And that's how I'll help people. You know, and I would still help you move or mow your yard or something like that, but... You know, I couldn't, I tried to work that out, and I don't know why I had gone away. I'd worked a lot, and I spent most of my time at work, and work had consumed my life, and being successful and all those things, and that's who I was. And I was out of work for about 3 months, and that was one of the biggest blessings of my life, and I would have told you April 29th when they cut me loose that my life had ended, and really my life had begun. And since then, I've had an awakening that is unequivocally stronger and more powerful than anything I've ever experienced, you know. And again, I really think that when I parted ways with my last employer, or the one before the one I'm at with now, that was another door closing behind me, the clang, and God saying, "Hey, man, what are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing." I said, "Get ready to get busy." And I got busy, you know. And I started attending the graveyard because that's where one of my pals was that would not stop calling me on the phone. And then one of my other pals was there. And I've really seen that. I've really seen, again, the fellowship grow up about me. I've really seen the power that pulls people back from the dead. It pulled me back more than once. You know, I've experienced that. My most current favorite part of the big book is the fundamental idea of God is as much a part of every man, woman, and child deep down, right? So those paragraphs tell me how I'm going to find that. It tells me that fundamental idea. And I like to look at it from the perspective of The fundamental idea of good is deep down with every man, woman, and child. Because I always knew that I was good. I always knew I was good. I always thought I was bad. I always thought I was a bad person doing bad things. And what I believe now is I was a good person that wasn't performing up to their potential. And I think that's the truth in everybody. And the fundamental idea of that is buried deep down within me. It's obscured by pomp, circumstance, worship of other things. But somewhere in there, it is there, like the feeling I have for a good friend. And if I look at those paragraphs, it says, I have to search fearlessly. Well, there's that. Where do those two words come out? Come out in the fourth step. They tell me I have to make a fearless and searching moral inventory. So I have to search fearlessly. And I can sweep off a little bit. I can get some of that stuff out of the way. And at the end of that paragraph, it ends with, the consciousness of your belief is quite sure to come to you. And that is indeed what has happened to me, 100%. I would love to speak with anybody at any point in time about that, for better or for worse, either way. And it's certainly a privilege to get to talk to Alcoholics Anonymous, talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, talk about God, get to be here with my wonderful wife, my best pal, one of the best friends. I got my stuff, man. I got my wife's AA charm. I got my pal's bolo that I asked him to bring, but I don't think he was bringing it for me. I think he was bringing it for my wife when she spoke this morning. And my new friend, Dirt, my Memphis people that, you know, they're here because this is where they come. Certainly hate that this is one of the last times that we will be able to do this in these buildings. But, you know, hopefully this thing will carry on, and I know that if it's supposed to, it will. And I got my dad's pen right here. It's his Olin Mills pen. And I love him. You know, I love my mom and I love my dad. And I love my friends and I love my wife. And I was incapable of doing that. I was probably incapable of doing that April 29th of 2021. You know? Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I care about the human race. I was incapable. My spiritual malady, as my friend says, is that I'm incapable of producing peace and ease in my mind and my spirit on my own. And I have to have Alcoholics Anonymous in order to do that. Thanks, y'all.